Greetings and matriculations, my uproariously monopelagial listeners, and welcome to this February 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this sub-xenophagian mockery of a science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Hey, hello, how are ya? How you doing? I'm okay. Our first story of the night is from a listener, Peter Hogberg. Sorry, Peter. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that umlaut over the O in your name. Anyway, Peter was very excited about this story. I think he likes the idea of taking a method from the hard sciences and reapplying it to the rather soft area of literature history. And I have to admit that I think it's rather cool, too, because the authors of this paper actually use similar methods that I use when I do analyses of DNA sequences and try to determine how similar or dissimilar they are to each other. It allows my lab to tell what species are related to what and how they may have evolved and things like that. Well, this new study, which was published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal, employed the same phylogenetic methods that I and my colleagues use to investigate the relationships between population, histories, and cultural phenomena, such as languages, marriage practices, political institutions, material culture, and music. The study was employed more specifically by anthropologist Dr. Jamie Tarani of Durham University to look at famous folktales and determine their origins around the world and just how old they were. Tarani says that Jack and the Beanstalk was rooted in a group of stories classified as The Boy Who Stole Ogre's Treasure and can be traced back to when Eastern and Western Indo-European languages split more than 5,000 years ago. Additionally, his analysis shows that Beauty and the Beast and Rumpelstiltskin are about 4,000 years old, and a folktale called The Smith and the Devil, about a blacksmith selling his soul in a pact with the devil in order to gain supernatural abilities, was estimated to go back 6,000 years all the way to the Bronze Age. Now, some anthropologists disagree with this, and they say that the job of smith was not even recognizable back then and didn't exist, so how could the story have been written or told in that manner? Tehrani says, quote, "We find it pretty remarkable these stories have survived without being written down. The stories were told before even English, French, and Italian existed. They were probably told in an extinct Indo-European language," unquote. In the 19th century, the brothers Grimm believed that many of the fairy tales they popularized, including Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Hansel and Gretel, and Snow White, were rooted in a shared cultural history dating back to the birth of the Indo-European language family. Tehrani says he doesn't believe scholars who say that some Brother Grimm stories were much younger and passed into oral tradition, having first been written down by writers from the 16th and 17th centuries. Quote, "Some of these stories go back much further than the earliest literary record, and indeed further back than classical mythology. Some versions of these stories appear in Latin and Greek texts, but our findings suggest that they're even older than that," unquote. I find this so amazing that Tehrani is really talking about the evolution of stories when all I ever look at are plants and animals. Okay, thank you. Next story. Can humans have superpowers that have not been created by Stan Lee? Well, the answer is yes. I came across this story in the journal Biotechniques, and I thought it was so cool because I never really think of any humans as having superpowers in reality. I mean, we live in a pretty prosaic world in a lot of ways. But here is an interesting list of quote-unquote superpowers. Now, you may not think some of these are superpowers, but they're still kind of neat. Number one, unbreakable bones. Do you remember the M. Night Shyamalan movie? The movie was Unbreakable. The entire premise of that movie is that there are people at both ends of the bell curve who are both incredibly delicate, as the Mr. Glass character of Samuel L. Jackson was, and at the other end of the spectrum, incredibly resilient, as the Bruce Willis character was. This does happen in real life, believe it or not. Thanks to a genetic mutation called sclerosteosis, some people, some humans, are born with bones that are several times denser than the average human. In theory, people with this unbreakable bone mutation could walk away from car accidents unscathed. At first, the thought of unbreakable bones seems like a blessing, right? But excessive bone growth can cause pressure on cranial nerves, on the brain, and it can sometimes even lead to hearing loss. On the bright side, doctors are trying to use the thick bone mutation to find a cure for osteoporosis and other diseases that cause brittle bones, the opposite. Ah, like Mr. Glass. Number two, the low cholesterol mutation. Now, I tell my biology classes what we put into our bodies affects our cholesterol levels, but genetics plays a huge role in the amount of cholesterol we have as well. Some people have a gene mutation, PCSK9, that causes a deficiency in the production of a protein called cholesterol ester transfer protein, CETP. CETP deficiency is linked with higher levels of good HDL cholesterol, which help people with the mutation maintain low cholesterol levels. So far, scientists have only found this rare mutation in a handful of African Americans, but the ones who benefit from it have a 90% reduced risk of heart disease. Number three, the inability to feel pain. Okay, so you don't think low cholesterol is a superpower? Remember painkiller Jane from the TV and comic? Jane had amazing healing powers like Wolverine, but actually, I guess her name was ironic and she felt her injuries. Imagine if you could be injured and not feel pain at all, though. Imagine being able to put your hand on a burning stove or prick yourself with a needle without feeling any pain whatsoever. Some people have a rare genetic mutation that makes them able to do, well, exactly that. It's called congenital analgesia. Just like the unbreakable bone mutation, it seems like the inability to feel pain would be pretty awesome. However, the condition is extremely dangerous, since people with the disorder could have serious injuries, particularly internal ones, and have no idea. The pharmaceutical industry is also attempting to capitalize on this genetic mutation, with the hopes of creating an entirely new class of painkillers that would be non-addictive. As usual, it'll be years of trials before any of those drugs are released, however. Number four, the super sleeper mutation. Now imagine having extra time than most humans have to do work or study or read or watch movies or whatever. Is that a superpower? Sort of. While most of us need about 8 hours of sleep every night, some people with the HDEC2 gene can feel totally energized on just 4 hours of sleep a night. Scientists call them short sleepers and have been working to discover exactly what predisposes people to need half the amount of sleep as the rest of us. Imagine how much more you could get done in a day if you had 4 hours extra. Number five, the HIV-resistant mutation. Is disease resistance a superpower? Maybe when it comes to deadly diseases. Some people have a genetic mutation that disables their copy of the CCR5 protein. This is the protein that's used by HIV virus as a doorway into human cells. If a person lacks the receptor CCR5, it's extremely unlikely they'll become infected with the disease, because HIV will have a reduced chance of latching onto their cells. Some homozygotes even have two copies of the gene mutation, making them the most resistant to HIV of all. Only about 1% of Caucasians have two copies of that mutation, and it's even more rare in other ethnicities. Number six, malarial resistance. Unfortunately, this superpower comes in the form of a blood disorder called sickle cell disease. People with two copies of the sickle hemoglobin gene suffer from a reduced ability to transport oxygen through their body. However, people with one copy of the gene, the mutant gene, and one normal hemoglobin gene lead healthy lives, and their condition renders them 10 times less likely to catch a serious case of malaria. Hopefully, scientists will be able to use information from the malarial resistance variation to produce more innovative malarial treatments in the future. Finally, number seven, the super sprinter variant. How would you like to be a super athlete, like Batman? All of us have a gene called ACTN3, but variants of the gene lead to different abilities in sports. Certain variants help the body make a protein called alpha-actinin-3, which controls fast-twitch muscle fibers and the flexing of the muscles during weightlifting or sprinting or any athletic event. It also controls the cells responsible for speedy muscle tensing. In 2008, geneticists who were studying power athletes and elite sprinters found that very few of them had two defective ACTN3 copies, whereas nearly 20% of the general population inherited two defective copies, rendering these individuals completely deficient in the speedy muscle contracting protein. This 2008 study is what led to ACTN3 being called the sports gene, and it could explain why some people are super athletes compared to those with no athletic ability, like yours truly here. If you also need two normal copies of ACTN3 to chew gum and walk at the same time, then I am probably a double recessive mutant. Well, what are you going to do? Okay, here's the big story right out of the news. See, I don't always ignore big stories. I tell them to you sometimes. Gravity waves have finally been detected for the first time since Albert Einstein predicted them 100 years ago. That was a year after his formulation of general relativity. Yes, actual gravity waves, which every SF aficionado has probably read for the last 100 years or so. Their existence was demonstrated indirectly and mathematically maybe 25 or 30 years ago, but it has taken all that time since to show that they are actually out there. Why? Well, two reasons. First, you need equipment sensitive enough to actually detect something which you would expect to be a massive alteration in space-time, but is not necessarily. And B, you need a massive gravity event to be detected. Now remember that it's much easier to see the result of a boulder being dropped into a pond as opposed to a pebble. That's kind of what we're talking about here. The paper was published in January in Physical Review Letters, and I'll be honest, and I have no idea who the main author was. There were at least 100 authors on this paper from all over the world, but the work was done at Caltech's Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. The detection occurred on September 14, 2015, 4 days before the official start of observations for the newly upgraded observatory. They actually made the discovery while they were calibrating the upgraded detector. The burst of waves arrived on Earth after two black holes, one about 36 times the mass of the Sun and the other about 29 times bigger, spiraled toward each other and coalesced into one giant black hole. Einstein's general relativity maintains that those black holes merged because their mass indented the fabric of space-time. And as the black holes drew near each other, they deepened the pit in space-time, also churning up the fabric of space-time and emitting gravitational radiation. Yes, gravity waves. Unlike more familiar kinds of radiation, like light and radio and microwaves that we're familiar with, my understanding is that gravitational ripples don't travel through space. They are vibrations in space-time itself, propagating outward in all directions at the speed of light. This is seriously cool stuff. I guess that nearly every accelerating object in the universe generates gravity waves. I produced them this morning when I drove onto the Garden State Parkway with my Toyota. Yes, they are feeble and undetectable, but gravity waves nonetheless. LIGO is fine-tuned to home in on detectable waves emitted from regions where a lot of mass is packed into small spaces and moving very fast. These black holes certainly qualify. Their tremendous mass was packed into spheres about 150 kilometers in diameter. By the time the black holes experienced that final plunge into each other, they were circling each other at about half the speed of light. The gravity waves emitted by those black holes during their last fractions of a second of independence encountered the LIGO detectors. Now, there are two of these detectors that work in unison. One is in Hanford, Washington, and the other is in Livingston, Louisiana. They each consist of a powerful laser that splits into 2 4-kilometer-long beams. When space-time is calm, the beams recombine at the junction and cancel each other out. The trough of one beam completely negates the crest of the second beam. But when there's a gravitational disturbance, especially from this black hole pair, it distorted space-time. It slightly squeezed one arm of the detector while stretching the other. When the beams recombined, the light no longer matched up perfectly. The detector sensed that crest missed the trough by the tiniest of amounts, It was about the 1,000th of a diameter of a proton. The LIGO facility registered the signal just 7 milliseconds apart, indicating a light-speed pulse from deep space rather than a slower-moving vibration from an underground earthquake or maybe a big truck rumbling along the highway. Why is this so important? Well, first, it's remarkable that this happened on the 100th anniversary when Einstein predicted gravity waves. But it also helped seal the deal in the Nobel Prize that was handed out in 1993 in physics to doctors Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor Jr. for deducing gravity wave emission based on the motion of a neutron star and its closely orbiting companion. Now Advanced LIGO has produced the first direct measurement. According to the LIGO Laboratory Executive Director, Dr. David Reitz, quote, "Gravity waves will allow us to look at the universe not just with light, but with gravity. Gravitational waves can expose the gory details of black holes and other extreme phenomena that can't be obtained with traditional telescopes. With this discovery, the era of gravitational wave astronomy has begun," unquote. So as they say in those car commercials, this changes everything. While we're on the subject of strange space objects, I have to report this story. Billions of light years away, billions and billions, there's a giant ball of hot gas that is brighter than hundreds of billions of suns. It's hard to imagine something so bright. What is it? Astronomers are not really sure, but they have a couple of theories. Dr. Christoph Stanek, professor of astronomy at Ohio State, and his research group have reported this incredible object in the journal Science last month. Stanek thinks it might be a very rare type of supernova called a magnetar, one so powerful it pushes the energy limits of physics, or in other words, it's the most powerful supernova ever seen. Stanek says, quote, "This object is so luminous we are having a real difficult time finding a way to describe it. If it is really a magnetar, it's as if nature took everything we know about magnetars and turned it up to 11, unquote. The object was first spotted by the All-Sky Automated Survey of Supernova, ASASSN, or ASASSN as they call the project. It's a small network of telescopes used to detect bright objects in the universe. Although this object is ridiculously bright, it still can't be seen by the naked eye because it's 3.8 billion light years away. ASASSN, since it began in 2014, has discovered nearly 250 supernova. However, this one stands out because of its sheer magnitude. It's 200 times more powerful than the average supernova, 570 billion times brighter than our sun, and 20 times brighter than all the stars in the Milky Way combined. Stanek says that, quote, "We have to ask, how is this even possible? It takes a lot of energy to shine that bright, and that energy has to come from somewhere," unquote. How bizarre is a magnetar? Well, to shine as bright as it does, this new supernova would have to spin at least 1,000 times a second and convert all that rotational energy to light with pretty much 100% efficiency. That would make it the most extreme example of a magnetar that is physically possible. Stanek says that if all that is true, we may never see anything in the universe brighter than this magnetar. Stanek reports that over the next few months, the Hubble Space Telescope will try to better characterize this mystery by giving astronomers time to see the host galaxy surrounding this object. They may find that the object lies in the very center of a large galaxy, meaning that it might not be a magnetar at all, and the gas around it is actually evidence of a massive, supermassive black hole. If that's the case, then the bright light could be explained by a completely new kind of event. It would be something that has never, ever been seen before at the center of a galaxy. Whether it's a magnetar, a supermassive black hole, or something else entirely, the results are probably going to lead to new thinking about how objects are formed in the universe. Well, the next story is kind of an update on one that I've discussed previously, having to do with humans and Neanderthals interbreeding thousands of years ago. Did this interbreeding have any effect on modern humans? Well, yeah, it did. When does breeding outside your own species not have an effect? Dr. John Capra of Vanderbilt University and his team reported this month in the journal Science that not only is Neanderthal DNA still with us, it affects us genetically. People of Eurasian origin are, genetically speaking, between 1% and 4% Neanderthal. And Capra's new research shows how this archaic DNA in their genomes may be impacting their health. The study utilized the electronic medical records and associated DNA data of more than 28,000 individuals to show that Neanderthal DNA had small but significant effects on the risks of developing, among other things, depression, skin lesions, and excessive blood clotting. Sequencing of Neanderthal genomes, isolated from fragments of bone, has revealed that modern humans contain remnants of Neanderthal DNA, a result of interbreeding between the two subspecies, as I have reported in previous podcasts. So, even though this DNA has been detected and there's an abundance of Neanderthal alleles, it's a little unclear whether those alleles have actual functional phenotypic effects on humans, and what they are. Capra devised an ingenious way to investigate such functional effects on a genome-wide scale. He states, quote, "We realized we had a great opportunity to answer these questions using large databases of anonymous versions of patient electronic health records linked to their genetic information. This is the first study that systematically goes through and uses the knowledge we have about genetic variations in humans to ask how much has integration of DNA from Neanderthals affected observable traits in humans," unquote. Within Neanderthal DNA found in humans, the researchers focused on the most common genetic variants and asked whether those variants were associated with any of the medical traits listed for the 28,000 patients. The researchers discovered associations with depression, mood disorders, and a particular type of skin lesion caused by sun exposure. Additionally, they picked out associations tied to tobacco use, urinary problems, and blood hypercoagulation. Capra says, quote, "The associations we observed are really, really small. While the links between Neanderthal alleles and certain human phenotypes were statistically significant, they only represented a tiny percentage of the risk, 1 to 2% in the case of depression, for example. You may ask why humans have not lost those Neanderthal traits. Remember that many genetic variants, regardless of evolutionary origin and temporal context, are beneficial in some respects, but detrimental in others. For example, while hypercoagulation may increase a person's thrombosis risk, coagulation is an early innate immune response that protects against injury and infection. As Neanderthals colonized new territories and were exposed to new pathogens, having a souped-up version of this response may therefore have been a favorable defense mechanism," unquote. Capra's team also found that Neanderthal-linked neurological and psychiatric traits were both overrepresented. This suggested to the researchers that the brains of modern humans have been particularly influenced by Neanderthal DNA. Capra says, quote, "If you had the hypothesis that Neanderthals died out because they were stupid, then you have to explain why their genes are here doing all this stuff in our brains," unquote. He concludes with this: "The takeaway from our work is that these genes that we have from these ancient people have effects on our phenotypes, and that's pretty cool. They are not just shadows that are not doing anything. They are actually participating in our biology," unquote. Okay, last story of the night. Sorry, but I have to report another mysterious astronomy story. I guess this is a big month for astro stuff. This one is going to make SF fans here a little bit nuts. Okay. Dr. Tabitha Boyajian of Yale has just published a paper in the journal Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society that tried to explain some mysterious observations on a star about 1,500 light-years away from us. The Kepler Space Telescope has unveiled thousands of exoplanets by tracking their shadows across the bright surfaces of their host stars. And every time a planet passes or transits in front of its star, it slightly dims the star's luminosity for a few hours or maybe days at most, and at regular periods that match the planet's orbit. But one star's eccentric shine has bewildered astronomers and inflame the imaginations of those in search of extraterrestrial intelligence. The star is KIC 8462852, and it sits between the constellations Cygnus and Lyra, about 1,500 light years away. Like many other stars, its brightness frequently darkens from shadows cast by transiting objects. However, the shadows on KIC create an offbeat light pattern, quite unlike any other. In the last 4 years of observing KIC, Boyajian and her colleagues have found that the star experienced two small dimming events in 2009, a week-long 15% dimming in 2011, and then a series of dimmings in 2013. At one point, it reached a depth of 22%. Even a planet as big as Jupiter would only be able to darken its host star by 2% at most. Boyajian says that the transits can't be caused by orbiting planets because they were too erratic, too dark. Instead, the pattern seems to indicate a massive irregular shape, most likely a bevy of objects. This shape could have been a protoplanetary disk. That's the cloud of debris that surrounds young stars before they settle down into a stable system of planets and asteroids. But the star is missing the infrared emissions that characterize a disk like that. The lack of infrared light also eliminates the possibility that the shape is a cloud of debris left over from some energetic collision between two planets or planets and moons or whatever. And lastly, the object must be a relatively new development or would have met its scorching doom at the hands of the star's gravity by now. So, what could it be? Boyajian suggests it's a cluster of comets as the most plausible scenario. If another star recently passed close enough to KIC, it would have brought along comets that are slowly disintegrating as they orbit the star, which would explain the highly aberrant dimming patterns. But this explanation has problems too. It's unlikely that this event happened in the relatively short time span that would allow us to observe these dimmings right now. It's also hard to imagine mere comets being able to block out a full 22% of a star's light, even a huge cloud of them. Of course, the researchers at the Center for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence have other ideas. They've suggested that you would expect an alien civilization to build massive structures around a star that would have that kind of dimming on it. If the giant planet-sized structures cast such dark shadows on KIC are truly some sort of alien architecture, then perhaps they're designed to capture solar energy. If that's the case, they would emit powerful radio waves detectable from Earth, say the SETI people. SETI says if they do pick up radio waves, they can progress to the Very Large Array in New Mexico to determine whether the radio waves are coming from a technological source. SETI is trying to get radio telescope time to examine KIC with a microscope, so to speak. If the SETI proposal is approved, the first observations may start in the next several weeks, with a follow-up planned for fall of 2016. The SETI spokesman, Dr. James Wright of Penn State, says, quote, "Even if we don't end up finding aliens this time around, this discovery presents the most compelling concept of an alien civilization we have ever encountered. And right now, there is nothing to suggest that the alien structure hypothesis is false." Unquote. Frankly, whether it's aliens or not, I don't care. But this is why I got into science. KIC 8462852 exemplifies the most exhilarating aspect of science, particularly of the cosmic variety that I find intriguing, that we really have no idea what's out there, and everything, anything may be possible. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't stare at magnetars too long, or you'll burn up. Blame your tobacco addiction on your Neanderthal forebears. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.